Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us. On today's show, we're going to take a look at veterans and where they choose to live after leaving the military. It's a pattern that's undergone a huge change in just the last few decades. 30 years ago, the nation's veterans population was fairly evenly distributed in large cities and small communities across the country. That is no longer true. Veterans appear to be clustering together in a relative handful of communities, and they're predominantly fairly rural areas in the South and in the Midwest. Those communities also tend to be home to military bases, bases that are growing smaller in number but larger in size as DoD consolidates its facilities. All that's according to Professor Jay Teachman, a sociologist who studies veterans and military service at Western Washington University. His paper, Analyzing 30 Years of Population Data, is due for publication in an upcoming edition of the academic journal Armed Forces and Society. Professor Teachman is our guest for the first part of today's show. The issue of the geographic clustering of American military life was also mentioned in some detail by former Defense Secretary Bob Gates in a 2010 speech at Duke University that got some national media attention. Gates worried that the military is becoming representative of fewer and fewer families in fewer and fewer areas of the country. We'll hear an excerpt from that speech later in the hour. Teachman told me that address was one event that prompted him to start his research, but so did some other observations.
What really got me going, and this is part of my longer-term research agenda on veterans, I've done a lot of research on the outcomes of veterans, such as their income, their health, and so on. And it just seemed to me that veterans were becoming scarcer and scarcer. So I started looking into it, and I came across Secretary Gates' speech and a few other things, and one of the other things that really got me thinking about this as well is the decreasing number of veterans that serve in the House of Representatives and the Senate. So I said, well, let's take a little quantitative look at the veterans and where they are in America.
And so it's really two things, right? It's the declining overall number as we're losing so many of our World War II era vets, and it's the concentration of the remaining vets in certain areas of the country, correct?
That's absolutely correct. The paper comes to two conclusions. One, the proportion of the population that is a veteran is in steady decline. And two, that steady decline hasn't been homogeneous across all of the United States. In other words, veterans are not only fewer, but they're tending to concentrate into a fewer number of geographic areas.
And so let's draw out some of that data a little bit more. When you compare your 1980 numbers to all the way through 2010, which is where I think you wound up, what are some of the most striking comparisons to you?
Well, the most striking comparison to me is not necessarily the decline in the number of veterans. You would expect that given the beginning of the end of the World War II veteran.
Sure.
There were such large cohorts of veterans, 70-80% of relative birth cohorts of men served. And in Vietnam is the next biggest group, and that was 25%. And today it's more like 7% to 10% maybe of birth cohorts are serving in the military. So it's becoming a much more rare event. But what really struck me, and if of course your listeners won't have the paper in front of them, but if you take a look at the chart, and it shows here are the places in the United States where there are large concentrations of veterans. And starts out in 1980, there's huge swaths of the United States where there are goodly concentrations of vets. But by the get to 2010, by the time you get there, there's just little tiny fragments of the U.S. where you find these concentrations of veterans. That means that most people probably don't have any contact at all with a veteran.
One of the stats that jumped out at me, this was really striking. So you broke out the counties across the country that were made up of at least 10% veteran population or more. That was 80% of all counties back in 1980. By the time you get to 2010, it's 26%. That's such a precipitous decline.
It is a precipitous decline. It's a tremendous decline. Counties with the, let me read you a couple stats here.
Yeah, please.
Counties with greater than 10% veterans in 1980, 2,500 counties. That's out of roughly 3,100 counties. 2,500 counties had 10% or more veterans. By 2010, that's down to 828 counties. Counties with greater than 15% veterans in 1980 started off with 145, and by 2010, it down to 49. And if you take a look at just at the big counties, you know, we've got places of 100,000 or more. In 1980, you had in veterans more than 15%. In 1980, you had 20 of those counties. Now you're down to nine counties. So it is a precipitous decline.
And it's important to look at it at the county level too, right? Because it's not, you can't explain the whole thing just by saying, well, veterans must like living in the Sun Belt. It's not like they're just all going to Florida and Alabama. When you look at it at the county level, they're clustering in counties or around specific areas, not just in states.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. As a matter of fact, if you take a look at the maps in the paper, if you look at Florida, which is a high concentration of vet state, the number of counties in which you have a high concentration of vets is dwindling. It has dwindled. So right now, if you take a look at Florida, it's in the panhandle, right around the Naval Air Station, where you find the largest concentration of vets.
Some of this, I would have to think, has been influenced, and you point out in your paper that these concentrations are around military bases in a lot of cases. So some of this has to be influenced, I would think, by the military base closure process. And I always think of the San Francisco Bay Area, where I lived for a while. You know, 30 years ago, there were several major military bases lining the perimeter of the bay, sort of. And today, there are really none in that giant, important metropolitan area.
Absolutely. It's base closure. And what happens is that you get fewer bases, but you get these big bases. Here in Washington State, it's Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It's huge. But the smaller bases that we used to have no longer exist. It's just one great big base. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in that one of the leading predictors of who is going to enlist in the military is that they have had contact with someone in the military. So people who have lived around bases are more likely to enlist in the military. Well, there's fewer of those bases now. So the people who are joining the military are coming from an even more restricted slice of the population.
So that speaks to sort of the currently serving military members, but your paper is mostly on veterans.
Correct.
What can we say, if anything, about why veterans are clustering around military bases?
Well, because veterans are former active military. So most of the people in the military, well, it's a little bit changed today. It used to be you do three or four and done. Now it's more six or eight and perhaps finish. Most people don't make it a career. So they become veterans in a fairly short period of time. So if they join from a place that's close to a military base, they're probably going to retire. Not retire, that's a bad word. They're probably going to become a veteran close to a military base. And it's also a place where they probably feel comfortable. Even if they didn't come from that particular area, they've moved to one of these bases at some point during their military career. You know, and they might have had two or three bases. They're likely going to choose one of those as a place to live. It's just because it's easy for them. They know it. Those communities are used to veterans. It's a welcome environment.
That second point completely makes sense to me, but at the same time, it's a little bit counterintuitive just because there's such a massive reservoir of goodwill toward not just the institutional military, but individual service members in the country right now, you know, contrasted with the Vietnam era. So I wouldn't expect that veterans are being, you know, driven out of certain parts of the country by hostile environments.
Good point. Yeah. And that's not the point. It's not being driven out by a hostile environment. It's being drawn to an environment that they're used to, that they have information about. It's one thing to think about picking up and moving somewhere where you don't have any context, you don't know anything about the labor market, and another thing to stay in an area where you do know the labor market, you do have context, it's probably easier for you to get a job. So I don't think it has anything to do with the warmness or the welcome. It's more of they just feel more confident and able to get by in this environment.
I wonder, too, how much of this you think might be explained by the end of the draft, in the sense that the draft was, you know, probably drew more equitably from across the country, geographically anyway. And I think we know that today's volunteer force comes predominantly from the South and the Midwest, right?
That's correct. I think the draft has a, the end of the draft has a lot to do with it. The draft was not certainly the perfect solution to an equal opportunity, equal representation, military, but it did a lot to that. So what's happened now is that there's greater geographic concentration of where veterans are coming from, first active duty people and then veterans, and that's being translated again back into greater geographic inequality in where veterans live.
You mentioned this slightly a minute ago, but I want to dry out on it a little bit more. In the sense that, is this a self-reinforcing phenomenon going forward? In other words, as you alluded to, people in communities that have heavy military populations, they have friends and family around them that have served or are serving, so they're more likely to enlist. And the services, therefore, see those places as fruitful recruiting grounds, so that's where they focus recruiting. Do you see this trend because of those kinds of things just intensifying as we go forward?
Absolutely. It's a function of having an all-volunteer force. And the vast majority of individuals in the young people in the United States probably are not going to be choosing the military as one of their first jobs or at all. And so what's going to happen, it's going to be those people that are most comfortable with the military, just because they know about it, they know people that are in the military, they're going to be joining. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's probably going to continue. I can't think of any way right offhand where short of quotas for recruitment by particular areas, we'd break that chain.
And do we know anything yet? I don't know how much this has been studied, but do we know anything yet about sort of the settlement patterns of this new generation of veterans, the Iraq-Afghanistan generation?
That's a great question. You know, I would really like to have some information on that myself. I just can't think of anything that's been done on that.
Jay Teachman is a sociology professor at Western Washington University. He's just finished a paper that shows that America's veterans are clustering themselves into fewer and fewer geographic areas around the country, down to the level of individual communities. We'll come back and talk about the implications of that shift for the military and society after a short break. This is on DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Our guest for this part of the hour is Professor Jay Teachman. He studies sociology at Western Washington University with a particular focus on military and veterans issues. Research that he will publish in an upcoming edition of the journal Armed Forces and Society shows military veterans now tend to live in a relative handful of communities across the country, something that was not true 30 years ago. Teachman says his research was motivated in part by a speech former Defense Secretary Robert Gates gave at Duke University 2 years ago. Gates worried that today's military is coming to represent fewer and fewer families and fewer communities. We'll talk more with Professor Teachman in just a moment, but first let's hear an excerpt from that September 2010 speech by former Secretary Gates.
That whatever their fond sentiments for men and women in uniform, for most Americans, the wars remain an abstraction, a distant and unpleasant series of news items that do not affect them personally. The military's own basing and recruiting decisions have reinforced this growing concentration among certain regions and families. With limited resources, the services focus their recruiting effort on candidates where they're most likely to have success, with those who have friends, classmates, and parents who have already served. In addition, global basing changes in recent years have moved a significant percentage of the Army to posts in just 5 states: Texas, Washington, Georgia, Kentucky, and here in North Carolina. For otherwise rational environmental and budgetary reasons, many military facilities in the Northeast and on the West Coast have been shut down, leaving a void of relationships and understanding of the armed forces in their wake. This trend also affects the recruiting and educating of new officers. The state of Alabama, with a population of less than 5 million, has 10 Army ROTC host programs. The Los Angeles metro area, population over 12 million, has four host ROTC programs. And the Chicago metro area, population 9 million, has three. It makes sense to focus on places where space is ample and inexpensive, where candidates are most inclined to sign up and pursue a career in uniform. But there is a risk over time of developing a cadre of military leaders that politically, culturally, and geographically have less and less in common with the people they have sworn to defend.
Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking at Duke University in 2010. Let's continue our conversation with Professor Jay Teachman on the same subject. Well, back to Secretary Gates's speech. He seemed nervous, for lack of a better term, about this trend of geographic clustering. As a sociologist, does it make you nervous? What are some of the potential ill effects for either the military or society or both?
Well, you know, Secretary Gates was concerned about mutual understanding. And I think that's a very important point, because the military is a substantial component of the federal budget. It's the point of the spear with respect to many of our foreign policy initiatives. And understanding the military would seem to me to be a very important component of managing that resource. One of the things that really has struck me is the decline in the number of veterans that serve. I believe in 1975, about 80% of Congress was a veteran. That's a phenomenal number. But by 2013, that number is down to about 19%. And so you're having people that have no experience with the military making judgments about military budget and military policy. And again, I might be mistaken, but I think in the House, the chair of the Armed Services Committee is not a veteran. And that's neither here nor there for one person, but with very few people having the information, that the understanding of the culture to make these decisions, it's not scary, but it does cast some doubt.
Well, to put that another way, the Congress is representative of the country. The military maybe is getting less so.
That's true. The Congress is probably more representative of the U.S. than the military is at this point in time. But the military itself is the people who serve should be able to become elected members because of the selection into the military is very high selection standards in terms of physical, academic capacity. And these are people that are given tremendous leadership opportunities at a very young age. People in their young men and women in their mid to late 20s are driving combat vehicles, flying expensive planes, driving boats, all the things that you have to do in the military at a very young age. They're leading people. They're leading people often in very strenuous, stressful circumstances. You would think that they would be the ones that would be seeking some kind of political office, or maybe people would want to put them up for political office, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
I think that's such an important point, because it's not as many people feared when the draft was ending, that our all volunteer force is made up of people who couldn't get careers in other fields. These are in many ways the best and the brightest of our country, and there are such a vast number of people in this country that couldn't get into the military just because they're not up to snuff.
Absolutely. These people that do get into the military serve honorably for their 3, 4, 5, 6 years. They have tremendous experiences, tremendous training. And you would expect those would be the ones that would rise to leadership roles. And maybe it will happen. Maybe after Iraq and Afghanistan sort of die down, and they get this new cohort that comes back home and takes charge.
So there's a lot of important public policy implications here. I think one of them is, what do you think the implications of the trends here are for the way the government delivers services to veterans? My impression is that VA is kind of built up of a network of healthcare and benefit services that's nationwide and somewhat evenly distributed. Do they need to do their own BRAC to realign the way they deliver services and where they deliver those services?
I would think so. The increasing geographic concentration of veterans into particular areas would seemed to me to make it important for the VA to target these services. You really need to provide this service where it is needed. But, you know, that's also a two-way, a double-edged sword, in that there, if you do that, you risk losing some of these veterans who don't live in these areas. But at the same time, to provide the biggest benefit to the biggest number of veterans, you should pay attention to where they're at.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that you've done a lot of work on the outcome for veterans. Is that one of the things you've looked at? You know, do people who are in areas that are less well served by VA tend to do poorer than people who are better served?
That's not one that I have investigated, but that's an important question to be one. That's a reasonable assumption. I have some, you know, anecdotal information from here, my own community in Whatcom County, which is way up in the northwest corner of the United States, pretty much next to the Canadian border. And there's a veteran community here. It's not large. And they regularly had to travel to Seattle to get any of their VA services. And they lobbied for a long time, and they finally got a satellite clinic set up in the county just south of us. So instead of going 100 miles, now they only have to go 30 miles for services. So I imagine there are groups of people that are going to suffer from lack of service, and that therefore their health outcomes won't be as good.
Hmm. Not knowing your previous research in detail, I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but does any of it dovetail nicely with what we're talking about here today?
Not particularly, because I haven't, up to this point in time, looked at the geographic context of service and what that means for outcomes. Basically, to this point in time, I've focused simply on whether you are a veteran and of what era, and how does that affect your outcomes. But what this research that I've just finished suggests now is that the geographic context of where you served and where you live after service is likely to be important. And it's important both for the veterans, and it's probably important for the community as well. For example, let me give you an example.
Sure.
Let's say that we're talking about the African-American community. And from whatever reasons, discrimination, whatever, African-American communities are often much more disadvantaged than white communities. And African-American men have more difficulty in qualifying for military service, yet they are overrepresented in the military. So what does that mean? It probably means is that the military is creaming the best African-American men from their communities. And then when they leave the military, they're probably not going back to these communities to take the leadership roles. They're probably remaining in communities around where they served. So what's happening is that the community that donated these veterans is left with least qualified individuals. And the communities that are gaining these veterans are gaining some very highly qualified people.
Before we let you go, the PR folks there at Western Washington gave us a heads up that you've recently been awarded a grant from NIH to work on issues around military service and troubled behaviors. Are you far enough down the road on that to give us a teaser on what you're working on?
I'll give you a little bit of teaser, not in terms of the eventual outcome, in terms of do veterans have fewer troubled behaviors. I'm going to flip the coin around. Do people with troubled behavior, are they more or less likely to enter the military? And I've sort of got some interesting results on that. And we just got done talking about the most qualified people tend to enter the military, but it also is the case that if you have engaged in these troubled behaviors beforehand, that increases your risk of joining the military. So if you're engaging in delinquent behaviors and so on and so forth, you can't get around the ASVAB part of it, and the cognitive ability test. You can't get around the BMI, the body weight stuff, you know. But the delinquency stuff, you know, if you've got these other qualifications, it seems that these young men and women who have this history of this kind of behavior are joining the military. And it may be the case, it's just a supposition here, that they see the military as a structured environment where they can sort of corral whatever tendencies they have. Mm. It's not the only predictor of enlistment, but it's one that seems to be consistent. Oh, and I say delinquent behavior, I'm, you know, like petty crimes. I'm not talking serious felonies and things like that.
Oh, okay. So you're talking crime specifically, not necessarily drug abuse or mental health
issues?
Oh, no.
As a matter of fact, the drug abuse thing doesn't seem to have any effect at all. I'm talking about people who might get into fights, maybe some petty theft or something of that nature, that kind of troubled behavior.
Professor Jay Teachman is a sociologist at Western Washington University. His study on American veterans and how they're concentrated in fewer and fewer communities across the country will appear in a forthcoming edition of the academic journal Armed Forces and Society. We'll post a link to an abstract from the paper at federalnewsradio.com. When we come back, we'll round out the show with a couple updates on military cyber issues. The latest from the Defense Information Systems Agency on creating standardized cyber training across the military. Then, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's exhortation to NATO to do more on cyber. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We've spent most of the show this week talking about the trend of geographic clustering among American veterans. If you missed our interview with sociologist Jay Teachman, who's been studying this, we'll post today's full program at federalnewsradio.com. We'll finish up the show this week, though, with a couple cyber updates. In a few minutes, some thoughts from Defense Secretary Leon Panetta on where NATO should head on cyber defense. First, though, an update on synchronizing and standardizing cyber training across the military services. It's an issue being worked on at the Defense Information Systems Agency. Henry Sinkowitz is the Vice Chief Information Assurance Executive at DISA. He gave a wide-ranging talk last week at the Northern Virginia chapter of AFSEA, which we covered here on Federal News Radio. We're going to hear a short excerpt from that talk now on cyber training.
You all are going after the exact same skill sets that we're going after. There are commercial entities, the banking community, the travel community, the hospitality community, the petroleum industries that are going after the exact same talent sets that we are, and they can incent them incent the team members in slightly different ways than we can. And this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to converge the efforts so that we have an end state that fully supports the JIE so that we're able to go there and have cyber platoons that are going there and are standard trained in a standard methodology, a standard way of behaving, so that we can use them in multiple ways. We want to make sure that they're all operationally focused and that there's a curriculum behind that. It doesn't do us any good to train someone up and go and say, here you go, we're going to make you a watch officer or a watch NCO, and then all of a sudden move them into another environment where they're absolutely and totally non-useful. And that's when you're hearing some of the discussion at the senior levels inside the department. The idea is, how do we go there and find that right curriculum training path? And I've got a slide on that in a second. How do we have those common standards so that we're able to go there and look and measure cyber readiness for the workforce? And then how do we have a set of policies and procedures that codify all of these operations? I mean, absolutely critical to where we're trying to go. So that the end state is down at that bottom purple thing where it's a unified cyber workforce that has the right policies and procedures all around it. I was asked the question as I was standing here earlier about where are we going with NIST and the NIST development and stuff. So let's be clear. The department is part of the federal government. We try to make sure that we follow the rest of the NIST standards. When we were building our cloud infrastructure, Peter Mell, the guy who wrote the standards, and I used to argue on stage very, very passionately about the topic. Some of you were in those rooms while some of those discussions were taking place. But we were very clear from the department approach that once NIST set up their standards, we would fall in behind it, and you've seen us doing that. You're seeing us using a lot of the stuff in FedRAMP for moving stuff into the cloud environment. You're also seeing us doing it here inside of using the NIST NICE framework to make sure that we're lined up. We clearly know that there are work roles inside the NIST inside the DoD framework that have no correlation whatsoever to what NIST is doing. There is not much of a need inside the NIST framework for the attack exploit side of the cyber workforce. We do have that. I mean, this is, nothing's classified. We know that we've got additional work roles. So we're just trying to make sure that we've adhered to them as best we can, so that when we have a federal employee, that federal employee can move from one agency to another department, and we know that they've got that common reference framework, that common training that goes across the environment. And our methodology, and I just want to talk a little bit about DISA, is trying to do this. I mean, we're mapping out a whole bunch of the roles right now. We've got a number of them on the docket to have up and finish, specifically inside the Computer Defense Network analyst side, both at the beginning, the intermediate, and the master practitioner levels. The team is supposed to report back out in March with the first iteration of the entire pilot. Last time I checked, which I freely admit was a few weeks ago, we were about 60-65% done with the pilot group on the beginner level, about 40% on the intermediate, and then about 10% on the advanced level, which was lining up with what we had projected for the training plan. The key that we're going to have to figure out still, though, is how do we do the other practicum? Because it's great to do all the training, and I think you've all sat in rooms with people with all sorts of certificates or degrees and stuff who really couldn't do the job. And the question becomes, how do we go there and have enough of a practicum so that we're able to go there and have some fidelity to understanding what they're really doing? Concurrent with that, though, is we want to make sure it's inside what's normally structured inside the Defense Department as that force generation process. We've all suffered through the idea of let's go there and retrain our workforce and go and drop new equipment in without taking into account the manpower and the cycles that are necessary to inject new training inside the environment. But if you look at our other in-the-field compatriots, they understand how to do that. You go there, you cycle units through, you get them in a reset mode, you get them ready, you put them available for the force structure. And we've got to do that same thing inside the cyber domain. And then we've got to be able to track it. And we've got to be able to hold commanders accountable for how well their units are positioned in that cyber readiness station. I think we'll be serious if you start seeing flags getting sighted on their fit reps or being removed from command if they're not ready. And I suspect that day is coming along, and probably coming along quicker than most of you would suspect. That's absolutely crucial, because until we see that readiness cycle and the troops understanding exactly how important this stuff is, I don't think you all know this, and I know this, is that we won't really achieve the necessary ends.
Henry Sinkowitz, the Vice Chief Information Assurance Executive at the Defense Information Systems Agency, talking last week at the Northern Virginia chapter of AFCEA. We'll stay with cyber when we come back. Some thoughts on the future of NATO when it comes to cyber from Defense Secretary Leon Panetta. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbit. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Finishing up the hour this week with another update on cyber in the Defense Department. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta spent last week on a farewell tour of sorts throughout Europe, likely his final big foreign trip before he steps down as secretary. He finished up the trip in the UK, addressing King's College in London, mostly on the future of the NATO alliance. We'll finish the show today with a short excerpt of that speech, focusing on emerging threats, including cyber.
We must develop innovative alliance cooperation. It will be essential to finally move away from the Cold War approaches to meeting alliance security commitments and instead embrace cost-effective, innovative forms of defense cooperation that are tailored to meeting the most relevant security challenges that we face today and tomorrow. NATO can no longer be an alliance focused on a single type of mission. Whether deterring the aggression of another superpower or conducting stability operations in Afghanistan. To be prepared to quickly respond to a wide range of threats In an era of fiscal constraint, we have got to build an innovative, flexible, and rotational model for forward developed presence and training. For the United States, that means we are making significant adjustments to the European force posture consistent with our new defense strategy. Yes, it includes the downsizing of some of our less relevant Cold War forces, such as the two heavy army brigades that we removed from Europe. But let me be clear that this effort is not primarily about cuts. It's about reshaping our cooperation for the new challenges ahead. That means even as we make some reductions, we will be supporting new rotational deployments, enhanced training, enhanced exercises, and other new initiatives that bolster the readiness of our forces and build their capacity to seamlessly work together. Whether deploying ballistic missile defense, such as our destroyers, our Aegis destroyers to Rota, establishing a new U.S. aviation detachment in Poland, deploying U.S. Army battalions on a rotational basis to participate in the NATO response force, we are making tangible investments in these new forms of cooperation to make the alliance more responsive and more agile. And we are doing so in a cost-effective way that meets our fiscal responsibilities. A second key line of effort is to make an investment in critical new alliance capabilities that will help maintain our decisive military edge into the future. For example, one of the key security challenges that I focused on during my tenure as director of the CIA and now as Secretary of Defense is the threat from cyber intrusions and cyber attacks. For years, I have been deeply concerned by intellectual property theft, by attacks against private sector institutions, and the continued probing of military and critical infrastructure networks. We are literally the target of hundreds of thousands of cyber attacks every day that probe every one of these areas. State and non-state actors are developing capabilities that could inflict extraordinary physical and monetary damage, could paralyze our economies and harm our infrastructure, take down our power grid system, take down our financial system, take down our government systems, take down our banking systems. That's a reality. That technology is real and threatening today. As societies that rely on cyberspace, Europe and the United States have more to gain from stronger cybersecurity than anyone else. And our economies are so interdependent, failing to act together could leave all of us dangerously exposed. This is an area where we are already working closely with our British counterparts. And during my visit to Madrid this week, I also discussed how we could work with the Spanish and with others to try to develop those capabilities. For its part, NATO has made important progress in strengthening the security of its own networks. But those steps alone are not sufficient to defend against the cyber threat. The alliance needs to consider what its role should be in defending member nations from cyber attacks. We must begin to take the necessary steps to develop additional alliance cyber defense capabilities. And to that end, I urge that in the coming year, NATO ministers hold a session to closely examine how the alliance can bolster its defensive cyber operational capabilities.
Defense Secretary Leon Panetta speaking last week at King's College in London on cyber issues in the NATO alliance and many other issues in NATO. Earlier in the program, we heard from sociologist Jay Teachman about the geographic clustering of veterans in America, a continuing trend that he's been studying. If you missed that interview, we'll post today's full show along with a link to an abstract from his paper at federalnewsradio.com. That's going to do it for today's program. Very glad you could join us. Please tune in next week. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.